speaking today with Bill White, the Democratic candidate for governor of Texas. Mayor White, we spoke before back in February during the primary season. I realize it's kind of a broad question, but can you just sort of give me a high-level overview of what's been going on with you in the campaign since you won the primary? Just very high-level.
Boy, Texans are ready for a new governor. I've been campaigning throughout the state and communities large and small. Texans, as you know, are a diverse people with a diversity of views as well as backgrounds. But we're proud of our state. We do know that despite Rick Perry's rosy claims that Texas has 1 million people unemployed for the first time, and many Texans are struggling as our unemployment rate is greater than in neighboring states. But, you know, people just want the governor who shoots straight with common sense and can bring people together to get things done. If there's one worry that the governor directly affects, it's the future of public education and access to higher education. People know that our dropout rates are too high and that Perry and his system has pressured teachers to teach how to take multiple choice tests rather than to have the critical thinking or career skills they need to get into college and do well or to get a good job. And they understand that education is the most important key to the future of Texas economy. I found a lot of responsiveness to Texas voters when we talked about, you know, our five-point education plan. And finally, you know, there's a growing sort of disgust with the use of, the use by Rick Perry of government to create a partisan political machine. The $17 million raised from people appointed to boards and commissions, the lobbyist ball that he had, his big statewide fundraiser, where 29 out of the 30 hosts were registered lobbyists, the effect of all that on our insurance rates and utility rates, that does concern Texas, and that cuts across party lines.
I'll get back to that in a minute, but to talk about education, you know, the difficulty is that we have all these needs for education at a time when we also have a big budget deficit, and education is a huge part of the state budget. You know, how do we reconcile these two things? How do we deal with the deficit and yet not, you know, not severely damage education?
Well, you know, first, in my administration, public safety, public education, higher education would come first. Second, we could make more efficient use of the dollars that are being expended by our public schools if we reduce some of the unfunded mandates on local school boards, if we gave local school boards more flexibility in everything from calendar to curriculum to the so-called accountability systems to do what schools need to do. There's been too much consolidation of top-down power in Austin as school board members across the political spectrum, and there is a tremendous waste that goes on in the public schools as a result of the fact that our schools are graded simply on the basis of an annual multiple choice test. You wouldn't believe the time and resources that are diverted from education into practicing test taking.
School districts around the state are feeling the pinch. There's a lot of cutbacks in local school districts. And there's talk again about another lawsuit over the way public schools are funded in this state. Previously, the issue had to do with equity. Now it's more a matter of adequacy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we can talk a lot about waste, and I certainly agree there is some. But there was also a big property tax cut of a few years ago, and monies that were intended to to be raised to make up for that haven't come anywhere close to it.
Yep.
What do we got? You know, how do we deal with that?
Well, you're right. There was budget malpractice, and to this day, Rick Perry has never just set forth to Texans the reason for the differences between what he projected and what he realized. And by the way, it is going to come home to roost during the next session after he leaves office, because we just found in the last 10 days, or they've just begun to admit what many people knew, their property values are going down, and that creates an additional liability for the state that commits to a minimum level of funding for these school districts. Now, I will tell you that no one should go into office saying that they have a plan in their hip pocket for redoing the school financing formulas. What we need is real leadership on the issue to build a consensus about improving our schools cost effectively. You've got to have the business community, unions, faith-based organizations, chambers of commerce, and alumni associations, all involved in the local parents and school boards, involved in an honest dialogue about what we do with school funding in the future. I can't tell you that it would be effective for me to say that I have a new formula to revise a formula that, as it is, only a handful of people who understand in the state. If we had a governor who explained the importance and got buy-in for accountable schools that are teaching people for what they need for careers and for to succeed in college, I think we'd be able to move forward. It's not going to be easy, but that's why we need new leadership. We know that if we continue our current leadership, the problem will be ignored until there's a lawsuit and there's a crisis, and then it can have a patchwork, solution like we had last time, which hasn't worked.
Okay. Now to talk about the issues of cronyism that you mentioned, as we know, as we speak, Dallas Morning News has published some investigative stories about the connection between the Texas Emerging Technology Fund, which was created by the legislature in 2005, and for which grants are supposedly controlled by the governor, the lieutenant governor, and the speaker of the house. Only turns out that an awful lot of grants have gone to people who've made large donations to Rick Perry. What needs to be done about the Emerging Technology Fund?
First, it needs to be thoroughly investigated. I mean, there are some things that smell to high heaven on that fund. I put, to Rick Perry three very simple questions, which he refuses to answer. First, just make public the objective performance criteria that they use to evaluate the success of these subsidies on a company-by-company basis. Every venture capital firm reports to its investors company-by-company how they're doing relative to milestones and what the next milestones are. And then as the investments, and then over time, the success of the investment. If it was really done in a business-like fashion, those documents should be readily available. Frankly, they ought to be on a website. But it appears as though they don't have any of those documents because it was more about politics and photo ops. Second, the governor should, reveal the investors in these various companies. He's refused to do that. There's no reason for withholding the investors. They sought taxpayer funds. These were not private funds. Nobody's asking for somebody to reveal a trade secret, but the names of the investors are no trade secret. He's afraid that journalists and the public will match the investors to his list of contributors. He also needs to make available his campaign staff who solicited these contributions concerning what they learned, what they knew, what their conversations were with some of these individuals who had received grants from the Emerging Technology Fund as well as the Enterprise Fund. He hasn't done those things. Finally, it's about time that the governor told members of the public if he or members of his family had investments with or co-investments with Mr. Adams or Mr. Nance or some of those people who are particularly close to the governor, who've been his political patrons who and fundraisers and donors who directly benefited from this fund. Those in that blind trust or in the names of his family members, if they own stock in any company in which Mr. Nance or Mr. Adams or any of these insiders participated.
You mentioned the Enterprise Fund, which was something that you brought up earlier in this campaign. You've got all these things, these different funds that the governor has control over, and everything else that he has his hand in, all the appointments he's made, the connections to lobbyists, some of whom have been former staffers of his. The recurring theme has always been that there's, kind of a tight network of people who are loyal to Rick Perry who get something in return for their loyalty. Now, none of this really is new news. I mean, Kay Bailey Hutchison made a big deal of it in the Republican primary, and it didn't seem to get her very far. Is the public really paying attention to this, or is it just sort of what we expect from Rick Perry, and we, kind of take it as the cost of doing business, if you will?
Some of both, but I haven't met a single voter who thought it was a good idea, and the sheer magnitude has not become apparent until relatively recently. For example, there was a report, the first comprehensive report, just a couple of weeks ago, about the fact that appointees to boards and commissions had contributed $17 million to Rick Perry. It just came up last spring. It hadn't widely been reported on, but there's no denying from the governor's office that he personally got a mortgage loan and a down payment loan for a rental property, failed to list debts of about $200,000 on his personal financial statement as required by state law, and it took mortgage interest, home mortgage interest deductions on the rental property, which he did not reside in as a home. And then it turns out that the banker for this unusual transaction was appointed to the UT Board of Regents. His wife was appointed to a university board, and even the banker's father was appointed to the A&M Board of Regents. Now, is that just a coincidence? I don't think so. And as the sheer scale of the corruption has become evident, I think you're seeing that the public is ready for a new governor.
Okay. Recent polling has indicated that there's quite a bit of support in Texas for more, an Arizona-style immigration law, which we know will, we know there'll be a bill brought up for that in the legislature. You have said that you oppose such a thing. How do you make that case to the public? What is the reason why such a law is a bad idea?
Well, I mean, the public has a right idea that we need to secure our borders. I mean, Rick Perry has been governor for 9.5 years. 4 years ago, he campaigned on the fact that he'd secure our borders, and things have actually gotten worse. My border security plan, which has earned the support of sheriffs representing 98% of millions of border Texans, would take real and concrete actions to secure the border, and that's what we need. We also need not just authority, but widespread implementation of a secure communities program where individuals who are arrested for crime, whatever they look like, whatever their ethnic profile, would be fingerprinted and checked against national FBI and immigration databases. That kind of program can identify those people who are in the category of deportable felons, and it has the added benefit, as we saw in Houston, of identifying people who have outstanding warrants who are citizens. And there are some people who are legal residents, but they are not citizens, where if they've committed a serious crime, their residency status should be revoked. Those are more effective ways. If we adopted the Arizona approach, by contrast, he would be taking officers off 911 calls and investigations, and eventually I'd expect the federal government to step back and just let local property taxpayers pay for routine immigration work, and we don't. That would make our communities a lot less safe.
Okay. There's been there was some stories recently about the use of social networking in the campaigns. I find all that very interesting, but what I think is of interest to me is how would you integrate that sort of thing into actual governance? What's the role of social networking in governing Texas?
I think it ought to be a mechanism for making the government much more responsive and transparent. You know, we did that some with the institution of email, what's called CitizensNet, which was sort of a creation of the city of Houston. No other city had something like this, where now people opt into the system, and we built it from scratch, where we even had to develop software for geocoding so that they could be, you know, geocoded messages affecting the neighborhoods. And now, I understand, it's grown to over 90,000 people can get information from City Hall that they have chosen to get. And we need to take that to state government and add the interactive social networking features. In addition, for those who are doing customer service, imagine if those who were doing permitting functions or inspection functions, many line workers on the state, put in a social network, you know, format, the status and progress of various inspections or licensing or permits, and allow the citizens access to that and to make comments on those. That would be a real improvement.
Okay. Transportation, very briefly. TxDOT, as we know, is short on money. What are we going to do about this?
And Charles, I have about 5 more minutes.
Okay.
Well, the first thing we need to do is trust the voters and trust local government. I would remove the restrictions on the choice of local funding options available to local voters. Right now, the state tightly restricts local governments to the use of property taxes to finance transportation infrastructure. And we all know that for many middle-class families, they can't afford an increase in their property taxes. There was a bipartisan consensus in the last legislature that more options should be available to the public, and Rick Perry said it vetoed that bill. I would support it. I believe in more local control. Second, we need to phase out the diversions of the motor fuel taxes. If we had the motor fuel taxes available for their original purposes, then we would be, not as many Texans would be stuck in traffic. It can't be done in one, you know, session. It can't be done in 1 month. But there needs to be a plan over 8 or 10 years. That's our truth in budgeting, where there's not these diversions. Finally, we need to build some, large, it takes leadership to build a large group of informed and knowledgeable people throughout the state about how we're going to finance these regional transportation projects, such as the expansion of I-35. You don't need to live along I-35 to be affected by the fact that a central artery running up and down our state can become a parking lot if there's an 18-wheeler. That affects trade, that affects commerce, that affects when merchants can get their goods, and it's a nightmare for the people who have to use that to 35 to get from where they live to where they work. I don't tell you that I should come in with some saying that I have a silver bullet and I'm smarter than everybody else, therefore I know exactly the formula that should be used, but we have bipartisan leadership such as Senators Williams and Corona and Watson and many others in the Senate, other House leaders, who feel that this should not be a partisan or ideological issue. It's important to move Texas forward.
Senator Corona, whom you've mentioned, has been an advocate of raising the gas tax. If he gets some momentum on that this legislative session, would you threaten a veto, or would you let him do his thing?
Well, I believe that that'd be a step in the wrong direction. Until we had a plan in place to avoid that version of the current motor fuels tax, because who would believe that there's these funds will be dedicated if we've been diverting them in the past. I also believe that there ought to be some mechanism that is similar for regional projects, similar to what we do all the time for 100 years in Texas, have voter approval of bond issues and indicate the source of funding of those bond issues and give voters an option of the source of funding. And I don't know those choices would be, but, I believe local voters ought to have those tools.
Looking at recent polling, just to switch to politics for a second, it seems like you're doing pretty well in persuading people who don't necessarily normally vote Democratic to support you, but there still appears to be an enthusiasm gap between Republicans and Democrats. What are you doing to get to ensure that the base Democratic vote is energized?
Well, I personally have seen and I have witnessed an enthusiasm gap, but it's far different than what you just described. I mean, my goodness, there will be many, many thousands of telephone calls made tonight in San Antonio, Dallas, Fort Worth, Beaumont, Tyler, Corpus Christi, El Paso, Austin, Houston, all throughout the state by people who want a new governor. There is anybody going by our volunteer offices sees a bustle activity during the weekends and in the evenings and during the urban areas throughout the day. You see it by the flood of small contributions we receive. They don't add up to some of the dollar totals that you get when Rick Perry can waltz in with $600,000 contributors, but we have far more, 10,000 more donors in the last 8 months, 9 months than Rick Perry's had in the last 3 years and 9 months. And I see that people are enthusiastic for a new governor. Sure, some of the national polls have to deal with Congress and the like show that, I guess, unfortunately, more polarization of the electorate. But here in Texas, I see people who are very, they're looking forward to having a new governor. And in contrast, I will tell you that our phone banks here are phoning into Republican, Democratic, Independent households every night. It is extraordinarily rare when one of these individuals calls somebody and they say, well, I think Rick Perry has just done a fantastic job as governor. That just doesn't occur.
All right, and just to wrap up before someone calls time on me, give me the 30-second elevator pitch for why we should have a new governor in Texas.
I will be a governor who treats state government as a public service, not as a political machine, unlike Rick Perry. I will work hard every day to prepare our adults and our young people to compete for good jobs, not these minimum wage jobs, good jobs with a real future. That means making college more accessible, reducing the rise in tuition, teaching our kids vocational skills where that's appropriate, and preparing them for college through critical thinking and not just how to take a multiple choice test.
All right. Mayor Bill White, thank you very much for taking time out of your busy schedule to talk to me.
You take care.
Thank you.
Thank you.